Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to another Greens List breakfast seminar on a very cold but not wet winter morning. I've got a sense of deja vu because we kicked off a series of talks in December and I gave a paper in relation to the proposed Law Commission review on Victorian Law Reform Commission review in relation to will making. And Terry Constantino gave a paper in relation to executors' costs that's being reviewed. And this is a part of an ongoing series of presentations that will be given by Greens List. Today we have a topic, the Vulnerable Willmaker, a survival guide. We've got two very excellent papers by two very excellent presenters. We have Eleanor Coates and Andrew Verspendonk. And reading Eleanor's CV, she's got a very experienced background in relation to wills and probate. Excuse me. She started her law career in 1999 with Tony Hargraves at Kenner Croxford & Co. Remained at that firm for 13 years. Excuse me. Headed up their wills and probate department. And she's got vast experience in both testator's family maintenance and complex wills cases. She's also an accredited mediator and has experience in mediations, particularly in the wills and estates field. She also has a criminal practice, worked on behalf of the Police Association and defence members, in defence of members in respect of serious criminal offences, coronial inquests, prosecuted matters under the Department of Human Services, Drugs, Poisons and Controlled Substances Act. And she's got a Bachelor of Science, Pharmacology, as well as Bachelor of Laws. So a very well-rounded background. Her paper today will be presented over a period of a half hour. We'll have a break for 10 minutes for coffee. We'll come back and Andrew Verspendonk will give his paper. Now Andrew is probably well-known to all here as well. He's got a very extensive and broad experience in relation to wills and estates litigation, been involved in many interesting cases, some reported, a number of papers that he's prepared and presented over time, including a detailed submission he put together personally to the Victorian Law Reform Commission in relation to succession law. My voice is going, theirs is going to go longer. So I present to you first, Eleanor.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you all for braving the elements to get out here. I'm talking, as you'll see, undue influence, capacity and suspicious circumstances or want of knowledge and approval. They are wallopingly big topics, so the paper is very detailed and I am really just going to skim the surface in talking to you this morning. Starting off with testamentary undue influence, and I'm talking only about testamentary undue influence, which is different to equitable undue influence. Traditionally, testamentary undue influence has been very difficult to prove. And what Kate McMillan said in a very recent judgment a couple of weeks ago was that the circumstances in which a court acting in its probate jurisdiction will refuse to admit a will to probate on the grounds of undue influence are different to a court acting in its equitable jurisdiction. So she was talking about the difference between the two doctrines of testamentary undue influence and equitable undue influence. What she said was, and it really sort of gets to the guts of the difference, is at equity there are a number of relationships in which it is presumed that there has been undue influence, including and especially familial relationships. Such a doctrine would be untenable in the field of probate, where appeals or affections or the ties of kindred are not just normal but expected in disposing of property by a will. Testators inevitably give great weight to the very relationships that a court of equity would presume to be undue. So what she's saying is you can't use the same principles because the reasons that an equitable undue influence case would get up are exactly the reasons that people make wills. Testamentary undue influence isn't presumed, but what you have to prove is conduct that amounts to coercion. So you can nag someone, you can beg, you can plead them to make a will in your favour, but you cannot coerce them. And the coercion must be to such a degree that the will no longer reflects the true intentions of the testator. each case is assessed on its own facts. And that is because different testators obviously have different vulnerabilities. Some may be old, some may be frail, some may be unwell. You may be dependent upon others for your activities of daily living. Justice Vickery looked at this in some detail in Nicholson and Nags, and that was one of the, I think apparently only the fourth case since the 1800s in which undue influence was successfully upheld. And what he talked about was influence being, the key concept being the influence. So influence moves from being benign and becomes undue when you can no longer say that the will reflects the testator's true intentions. He said it's the effect rather than the means which is the focus of the principle, and that the effect can be achieved in the context of a variety of circumstances and relationships. It can be a chain of events, a single event, it can be one person, it can be many. But what importantly he said was the influence need not be intentionally exercised by a particular person or persons for the purpose of overbearing the free and independent will of the testator. So you look at the effect of the conduct of the person exerting the influence rather than their intention. And this was recently quoted again by Justice McMillan in this case of Brown and Gus that came down on the 2nd of June. The burden of proof in undue influence is on the person alleging the influence, and that doesn't move. So the person alleging the influence must prove it. They must do that. And there was a big question about the standard of proof, and this is why it had been traditionally thought it was so hard to prove undue influence, because what the courts had really looked at was, as Justice Vickery said in Nicholson and Nags, he thought it amounted to virtually a criminal standard of proof where it was the only reasonable hypothesis. But what Justice Vickery said in Nicholson and Nags was, if you have direct evidence, which is pretty unusual in undue influence cases because obviously the testator has died, whether on the balance of probabilities the will of the willmaker was overborne by the requisite degree by conduct proven by direct evidence, so you prove that direct evidence, but in the more common circumstance where there is circumstantial evidence, you look at whether the circumstances raise a more probable, and that should read inference, in favour of what is alleged than not, after you look at the evidence as a whole. So you don't need to prove each of those circumstances. What you do is you look at the circumstances as a whole. Now, Justice McMillan, as I said, looked at this in Brown and Gus, and what she said, and she acknowledged that Justice Vickery had said these things in Nicholson and Nags, and said, the standard to which they must show that the circumstances are so is on the balance of probabilities. So we're talking about the standard of proof. If all that they are able to prove is that undue influence and a lack thereof are equally likely, then they have not proved their case. What they must show is that on balance, the hypothesis that the testator has been unduly influenced is more likely than the contrary. And what she says is that's not quite the wording that Justice Vickery used in Nicholson and Nags, but she doesn't think she's saying anything different. She's just putting it in her words. And so that is, as it stands today, the current test of the standard of proof required in undue influence cases. If you are successful in proving undue influence, then the piece of the will that is affected by that influence will be struck down. Now, that can mean that the whole will fails if it's something in a chain of events or a chain of gifts, or it may be that the entire will is affected by undue influence. Now, Andrew's going to look at Brown and Gus in some detail in his part of this presentation. He's talking about the practical implications of the law. And in that case, it was a really good contrast between a will that was prepared at the behest of a son who organised his lawyers, and those lawyers then took over, and he took no part in the preparation of the will. The instructions were taken independent of him by a law clerk who kept notes, saw the testator alone, and did all the things that one would expect. The contrast in that case was a will that was prepared in the presence of and at the behest of a particular grandson. And that grandson was really helpful in providing instructions and making suggestions about what money he could use and how maybe grandma would like to pay his mortgage. And ultimately a will was made that really complied with his instructions. So it was a really great example of good practice and not so good practice. Now, Richard mentioned the future and the VLRC paper. they looked at the issue of undue influence, and basically what they said is, I think it's around now, the Canadian system is bringing in issues and aspects of the equitable undue influence doctrine. And so what they're looking at is, if a person is in a position of dominance and that you can demonstrate they've used that influence, then there is a presumption raised, and in that case, the burden of proof will move to the person who is seeking to uphold the will. So that's the opposite of the situation that we have now. Australia's going to watch that position over the next 4 years and see what happens, and we may or may not follow suit. In the meantime, I wonder if the comments that have been made in Nicholson and Nags and about Nicholson and Nags about the standard of proof will in fact be enough that we don't need to go into that Canadian system. In the meantime, what the VLRC have suggested is that our Law Institute prepare guidelines for solicitors and give some assistance and guidance as to things to watch out for and how to handle the situation. In the meantime, at the end of this paper, I've got some references, and I've made reference, I think, in my paper to them. There is a New South Wales Law Society handbook, which is fantastic, and also the British Columbian Law Society. Moving on to what I think in New South Wales they love to call the doctrine of suspicious circumstances, but what we more commonly refer to as want of knowledge and approval. The principles of the doctrine were initially set out in 1918 in Nock and Austin. What that case said, that if you've got a will that is duly executed and you can show that the testator had testamentary capacity, then you've got prima facie evidence of the validity of that will. Once suspicious circumstances are established, then the burden moves to the propounder of that will, and they have to show with positive evidence that the testator knew and approved the contents of that will. The court must be satisfied that the document signed, so the will, reflects the true intentions of the testator before probate can be granted. So your classic situation, if a beneficiary is active in the preparation of the will, then generally there's suspicion, and what the courts have said is that requires anxious examination. So the court has to look into whether the testator knew and approved the contents of that document. The rule requires vigilance on the part of a court, but just because a beneficiary has been instrumental in the preparation of that will, it doesn't necessarily prevent it being admitted to probate. Again, each case is looked at on its own facts, because like all of these cases, no two are quite the same. And what the beneficiary or propounder must do is clear away that suspicion. So the classic example is the beneficiary instrumental in preparing the will, organising the solicitor, giving some instructions. And by doing that, particularly if they're the appointed executor, they bring upon themselves the onus of proving that the testator knew and approved the contents of that will. Justice Ginnane looked at this in quite some detail in Veal, which was a case I'll come to in a moment, and that has, in that he quoted a New South Wales Court of Appeal decision of Tobin and Ezekiel. Now, the details of these cases are in the paper, but what he quoted was that the authorities suggest that the suspicion is concerned with the will's contents rather than the circumstances surrounding the process by which the intention expressed in the will was formed. So again, you look to the will document to establish the suspicious circumstances rather than necessarily looking at family relationships and the like. Again, the burden of proof starts with the person challenging the will, so they must establish the suspicious circumstances. But once they've done that, the burden of proof moves to the propounder of the will to prove, again, affirmatively, that the testator knew and approved the contents of the will. The standard of proof is still on the balance of probabilities, but what's been said in the cases is the Brigginshaw standard is applied. So what that means is it's a serious allegation to make. Instead of being satisfied 49-51 that, oh, look, they probably did know, you actually have to give some positive evidence, and the court must be satisfied to the standard given the seriousness of the allegation. So they need to be positively satisfied that the will maker knew and approved the contents of the will. In Church and Mason, it was a great example of a situation that on the face of it looked like the will was never going to get through. It went to the New South Wales Court of Appeal. We had an 88-year-old testator who was very unwell, quite frail. There was a beneficiary who gave them a list and said, look, here's four options. How do you want your will divided? Option one, give it all to me. Option two, give it to me and someone else. And so it went. And so this person arranged the solicitor, got the solicitor out. The solicitor came, signed the will whilst this person was gone, but they were still in the vicinity. Ultimately, the will was admitted to probate, even though the circumstances looked very suspicious. The propounder was able to satisfy the court that the testator knew and approved the contents by virtue of that intervening solicitor who had come and seen the testator alone. And again, Andrew will cover it in a lot more detail, but the solicitor was instrumental. I mean, without their evidence and without their notes, they would never have been able to prove that the testator knew and approved the contents of that will. Again, in Nicholson and Nags, this was a case involving undue influence, testamentary capacity, and again, the suspicious circumstances document. And what, again, it was an elderly testator. Her vulnerability was that she was not unwell, but she was very isolated. She didn't have family, so she had powers of attorney to friends. She lived on a rural property. I think her residuary estate was worth about $15 million, so she was a wealthy lady, quite vulnerable. And what Justice Vickery said is, in terms of knowledge and approval, it is one thing to read out the clauses in the will, even explain their meaning to an elderly client, but it is quite another thing to ensure that they have understood the clauses and the explanation and that they understand the effect of what they are doing. So to know and approve the contents of a will, it's not just a matter of understanding what the words mean, but what their effect is. What Justice McMillan also said is, and others have said as well, it doesn't mean that they need to understand every word in the will, but they have to understand what they're doing and what the effect of those words is. Again, this issue was looked at in Veal and Veal, and in that case the will was not admitted to probate because of this ground, so they made out the ground of want of knowledge and approval. In that case, it was a 90-year-old testator who had the early signs of dementia. He was quite an unwell man. There was friction within the family, from children from a first marriage, children from a second marriage. So again, the will was challenged on all three bases: lack of testamentary capacity. It didn't have undue influence, and want of knowledge and approval. And again, it was the contents of the will that gave rise to the suspicious circumstances. They didn't look at the family and the relationships. But what had happened was that the person challenging the will noticed a change in the will-making patterns. And the court actually went through in the judgment each clause of the will and how it had changed. And some of the changes on the face seemed quite trivial. He'd given his gun collection to somebody and altered that. But it turned out his gun collection was a particularly valuable asset and something very special to him. So that change was actually quite significant. Now, unfortunately for the propounder, who was a son and a major beneficiary, he said at the trial, "Oh, Dad had signed anything I put in front of him." That was the end of it. It turned out that the court couldn't be satisfied that he knew and approved the contents of the will because the solicitor couldn't help. He had no notes, he had no file. He was a family friend who met the testator in a coffee shop, took some instructions, came back to another coffee shop and said, "Oh, here you go, sign this, it's all done," and he did. So unfortunately, that was the end of that will, and although capacity was doubtful, the court didn't find he lacked capacity. They found that he didn't know and approve the contents of that document. In Brown and Gus, now this case, and I'm sure Andrew will say the same, it's a must read. It's hot off the press. It is, I think, 122 pages, but it is well worth it. It is the ultimate definitive works on these topics. In that case, the final will was admitted to probate, and again, it was a case covering undue influence, capacity, and want of knowledge and approval. The final will was consistent with the previous will makings of the deceased, save for the penultimate will that was quite a change. The penultimate will was one that the grandson had been instrumental in preparing. The main beneficiary was a son. He was the propounder of the will. He was the executor. He wasn't present during any part of the will-making process, but it was the firm that he and his son used for their commercial workings that had prepared the will, and he'd arranged the initial appointment. There were independent solicitors and ultimately a will clerk who was involved, and she had phenomenal notes. She'd seen the testator alone. She could say, "Look, I'd been there for 1.5 hours. This is what we talked about. This is what we did." And she was able to demonstrate to the court that the testator knew and approved the contents of the will, that she understood what it all meant. If you look at another will, again, the one prepared or at the behest of the grandson, Justice McMillan ultimately considered that that will had been procured by the undue influence of the beneficiary, but she didn't come to consider the want of knowledge and approval. But I suspect if she had, she would have said that the testator didn't know and approve the contents of that will. It had been signed in the presence of the spouse of the grandson, whilst the testator was in bed unwell, in her bedroom with a whole mountain of other people in there. And what the court said was really, I mean, that's just not an appropriate way to have a will witnessed and to be able to be satisfied, again, of influences and that the testator knew and approved the contents of that will. But ultimately, in that case, Her Honour did not consider want of knowledge and approval. Moving into testamentary capacity, I just love quoting Banks and Goodfellow. It's the original test, but it has been modernised. But it uses the language of a person not having a disorder of the mind or insane delusions. What all of that really means is there are four elements in testamentary capacity, and you need to demonstrate all of them so that the will maker is aware of and appreciates the significance of the act that they're about to undertake. They understand it's a will and that by signing it they're disposing of their assets upon their death. That they're aware, at least in general terms, of the nature and extent of their estate, so what it is that they're disposing of, what it's worth. Justice McMillan looked at that issue, particularly in this Brown and Gus, and what she said is it's not a memory test. They don't need to be able to list their assets and ascribe a value to each of them, but they need to have a general understanding of what their assets are. What she said in that case is it's quite common for an elderly, in that case testatrix, to have handed control over to somebody else under a power of attorney, and there's nothing wrong with that. They've just got to have a general understanding. The third factor is that they've got to be aware of the people that they're obliged to provide for, so people who may have a claim on their bounty and the nature of that claim. And finally, they have to be able to evaluate between the strengths and weaknesses of those claims over their estate. It's a legal test, so even though it's a good idea to go off and get a medical report about capacity, ultimately it's not a medical decision, it's a legal test. All four factors must be present, failing which there will be a lack of capacity. What Justice McMillan also did in Brown and Gus, and it's worth a look, is she set out 12 factors instead of four. But what those 12 factors are that the 12 things that the court will look at if they're faced with someone challenging the will on the basis of capacity. So if you're concerned about it, it's worth having a look to say, well, these are the 12 points I'm going to need to meet to get this will through. Capacity can fluctuate. Nicholson and Nags was a great example where Justice Vickery talked about what's called the Noddy syndrome, where you get gratuitous concurrence, an elderly person who will just agree because they think they want to please you and they want to hide their inability. And so what Justice Vickery said was the medical evidence in that case was that an elderly person whose cognitive capacity is diminishing may give contrary indications of competency at different times and in different situations. People may have good days, they may have bad days. And even you may find, in particularly with dementia, different times of the day can affect abilities as well. What he said was people of a great age may have capacity even if they have dementia. So a diagnosis of dementia doesn't automatically mean that the person lacks capacity. Capacity is relative to the task at hand. So a person may have capacity to make a simple will, but that same person in the same situation may lack the ability to make something a bit more complicated. And again, in Brown and Gus, Justice McMillan gave a great example of this, and she said, if you've got a testator who gives someone, say, a gift of $20,000, and then they give someone else a house worth considerably more, but in their mind they think those two assets are equal in value, then they're probably lacking in capacity because they're missing that ability to appreciate the value of their estate. Whereas if they're not sure of the value of their estate, but they say, look, I want to treat these people equally, so I'm just going to split my estate in half, then they probably do have capacity because even though they don't know the precise value, they understand the competing claims and they understand and are giving effect to their intention to treat people equally. So again, it was just a really good example of the different subtle differences that can make quite a difference in capacity cases. The burden of proof in capacity cases rests with the propounder of the will, and it doesn't move. So that person has to show that the testator had capacity at the time of giving instructions, but also when they come back to sign the will, that they understood that the document they were signing was the document they provided instructions for, and they understand again the effect of signing that document. So you need to demonstrate capacity at both of those times. And again, it's not essential that they understand every word in every clause of the will, but the general effect. Again, the standard of proof is the balance of probabilities, but it's a serious matter, so the court needs to be affirmatively satisfied as to capacity. Again, not 49-51, they probably were, but that they in fact were. And so what they call the Brigginshaw principles apply, given the seriousness of the matter. So what does the court look at? When looking at capacity, the court will clearly look at the GP, the treating practitioners. It's very common in these cases to get someone out who will look at the files and give an expert opinion, someone who hasn't necessarily ever met the deceased in their lifetime. They look at family, friends, carers, so people who were around the testator at the time. And most importantly, they look to the solicitor. Ultimately, again, it is a legal test, so ultimately the call rests with the person drafting the will. Because I've got a few minutes, I think, I wanted to have a quick look at Nicholson and Nags because it was such a good case. And again, most of this happened again in Brown and Gus, but Nicholson and Nags was your classic hamburger with the lot. We had issues of capacity, undue influence, and just a dash of suspicious circumstances on the side. There were multiple wills drawn by ever-changing practitioners. There were a couple of codicils thrown in. There were instructions coming through friends, and that wasn't entirely unexpected because these friends were acting as power of attorney. There were, unfortunately for them, also they were the beneficiaries of the will, but again, not entirely unreasonable because this woman had no family. She was an elderly lady who lived in, I think, Mount Martha, so she was reasonably isolated. She wasn't mobile herself. So she was dependent upon others for her activities of daily living. Again, what the court did is they looked at the wills. So rather than looking at all of these circumstances that came in later, they looked at the change in the will-making patterns. One solicitor, unsurprisingly, the solicitor where the will was upheld, probed, tested and questioned the testator alone until he was satisfied that she had capacity and that she knew and approved the contents of the document she was signing. He had extremely detailed notes of every part of the process. He could tell the court who had brought her to the appointments, who had rung, who had left messages, who had said, oh, look, she wants to change her will and make this alteration. So he had the lot. So the will was upheld, save for one clause that was struck down for the benefit of one of the beneficiaries. And this is where the court talked about this gratuitous concurrence. The court said that she'd just taken the path of least resistance. She didn't want to create, I think, rock the boat was the phrase they used. So she just agreed, yep, that's what I want. And what the court found was one of the beneficiaries who had been passing on instructions and had managed to get himself included into the will had exercised undue influence over her. And so that piece of the will was struck down, but the rest of it was upheld. On the other hand, the other solicitor did not notice the alarm bells and didn't act on them. He didn't have many notes. I think Andrew will give you the number of words of how many notes he had. He couldn't help the court either on the question of capacity or on the question of knowledge and approval. And so he had prepared the final will and it was not admitted to probate. Unfortunately for him, he'd also acted in a property transaction where at the behest of the powers of attorney and the beneficiary's property had been sold, they were receiving the benefit of the sale and he collected a nice little commission on the way. So his credibility probably had some issues to start with. The further references that I was talking about, what you'll find in the paper is I've attached some checklists which are really handy. They're from the British Columbia handbook and they're very, very basic. I think they might be in a separate document in the folder. Very basic ticker box pro formas that are really good to go through if you're concerned and even if you're not, just to raise the flags of undue influence, of questions of capacity. There's a little flow chart that explains when it's appropriate to prepare a will, when it's appropriate not to, and also to talk about when someone might be under the undue influence of another, when you may not be aware of it directly. The British Columbia Law Institute also has a handbook. It's about 30-odd pages long. I've got it. I'm happy to provide a copy. If you drop me an email, I can send it to you. It's a phenomenal, very practical guide, as is the New South Wales Law Society book, which is called When a Client's Capacity is in Doubt. So again, a very practical resource for checking out capacity, asking the right questions, and all of those sorts of issues. Other than that, I'm finished. I think question time's at the end, so we'll have plenty of time for discussion at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Eleanor. And can I say, if you get a chance to read Eleanor's paper, it's very detailed, it's very informative, and well worth reading, as are the attachments to it. Yeah. Now, our schedule provides for a quick 10-minute coffee break.